Friday edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, finishing up 15-60 on the Western Conference, going to do Minnesota through Utah. We're sponsored today by Hubble Contacts. You can get a fresh pair of lenses every single day for $1 a day at HubbleContacts.com, where you can get 20/20 vision for half the price of normal contacts, and get your first 2 weeks of lenses for free. And ZipRecruiter. My listeners can post jobs for free on ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/capsules. They aggregate tons of candidates together from various sites. Saves you a bunch of time. Should we get started here? And we're doing this on Thursday, so it might be a little out of date by the time we run this Friday, but nonetheless, still good, we hope. Minnesota Timberwolves, Danny.
Hey, they don't play on Thursday, so we don't have to worry about that. 26-37, 8-8 since the last time we did this. They are 11th in offense, 22nd in defense, a slight positive net rating, 0.3. And after all of the weirdness that happened yesterday, they upped from a 5-10% chance of making the playoffs. And now the 538 projects them to be 11th in the West with 35 wins.
Yeah, Jim Peterson noted when he came on my podcast almost 2 months ago now that they had played very well since December 13th when they had that crazy comeback win in a Thibodeau Bowl one against the Bulls. Since that time, overall 2.0 net rating with Wiggins and Towns on the floor, they're at 3.6 and 3.5 net ratings respectively. The defense still has not been that great during that period, though. That was one of the things that everyone was saying was supposed to be good. But it's not, you know, remember they were like 27th in the league for the first month. You know, they've improved a little bit off of that. They're kind of just a bad defense now instead of an atrocious one since then. So things are really kind of looking up for this Wolves team. They may not make the playoffs. It might be nice if they maintain their draft pick. I mean, they're looking like now they're going to be in this tier where they're almost certain to be ninth or worse if they keep playing this way, because a lot of the teams right below them are probably going to be, are either bad or in tank mode. But you know, I think the fact that they're playing better is encouraging for this Wolves team, and maybe next year we can talk about them more legitimately going into the season the way people were talking about them this year.
Right. And one of the factors that I wanted to look into for Minnesota this year as a big defining thing, I think this was more true earlier in the season, is that NBA.com, the stats site, defines a close game as being 5 points or closer within the last 5 minutes. Minnesota is 11-21 in those games, and they have a negative 9.6 net rating. If they're even 500 in that, they're right in the mix for a playoff spot.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you noted the 0.3 net rating. To be 11 games under 500 when you have a positive net rating is obviously very disappointing. And I think the Wolves now, KP and I were talking about this at Sloan, the Wolves are now like, it's been like 7 straight years or something that they've had a worse record than their point differential, including maybe one of the all-time teams in that regard, that 13-14 team with Kevin Love that had the point differential of like a 48 win team and won 40 games. So, I mean, I don't think over the number of regimes and players that they've had in there that there is something systemic about that. So you have to hope that, hey, we can take them playing at the level of a 500 team over the course of this year. One thing that's been interesting is, now granted, LaVine wasn't playing that well. They haven't missed him at all, really. Do you agree with that?
I do. It's they have other guys that are, you know, somewhat similar in terms of the strength. They don't need his strengths that much. Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
Yeah. Because they don't have anybody else, really. I mean, Brandon Rush has been getting the minutes that he was getting, and he's got a 7.3 PR. Now, he does at least shoot 39% on threes, but he doesn't take a ton of them, and he just is completely useless inside the arc where he's shooting 34%. But maybe even just having someone to spot up is, and Towns and even Wiggins have been so good. I mean, Towns has been unbelievable. I think he's up to like sixth in the entire NBA in KP's warp statistic, he was telling me, which is pretty impressive. So, you know, maybe Towns, we kind of sloughed off on him a little bit early on as they haven't played that great a defense, but you know, I think he offensively, he is absolutely right on schedule.
Right, and that's what we were talking about when we did that awards podcast, or maybe it was after that, about how, for me, Towns has jumped DeMarcus Cousins in terms of... Oh, that was in the Reddit mailbag, about how Towns has jumped Cousins in terms of the offense-first centers, All-NBA and all that sort of stuff. And that's an accomplishment. I mean, DeMarcus Cousins is a very talented guy. Another big factor in this has been Nemanja Bjelica, who has been playing better, and they've also been utilizing him better. And he is actually leading the Timberwolves in net rating since February 1st.
Yeah, 14.8 net rating when he plays with Carl Towns as well. And that was the lineup that I had carped about that I wanted to see so much. And then Bielitsa just hadn't been that good during that time. But now it's starting to make more sense where Towns is at center. I mean, they've been scoring incredibly well with those units where Towns can really be the offensive focal point. They get a little bit more spacing. They actually guard Bielitsa, which is nice out in the perimeter. One other thing I wanted to look at was this idea that Andrew Wiggins has gotten so much better on defense, right? Like, I got a lot of crap in the Reddit mailbag for saying, oh, you know, he's still not that good defensively because he's playing so much better over the past month. Well, number one, there's his entire career versus the past month. I get it that for young players, it's always difficult to separate between, okay, what is just them getting it? We expect them to improve, and what could be just noise and someone playing really well over the course of a month. I'm not ready to go there yet. It's encouraging. It's a reason for optimism, but I'm not this like, oh, because with young players, you always are like, oh, this could be the game where he gets it. This could be the game where he turns the corner. And, you know, it's usually progress is a little bit less linear than that. But I decided to go back and look and see why it is specifically he's been getting a ton of steals lately. Still, you know, doesn't get any blocks or rebounds, really. He's had more than one block in a game once all year. He's averaging 0.4 blocks per game. But it is very interesting. Through the 40th game, he was well under one steal per game. And then over the last 20 or so, he's averaging 1.6 steals. So I watched all those. I think he's been doing a good job of getting into the passing lanes a little bit more, anticipating plays when he's the defender on the weak side, stuck in between two people, long looping passes. He's had a couple of nice plays where he's intercepted that. He's been getting more deflections as well with that 7-foot wingspan. When he's on the ball, guys trying to pass around him, he's actually been able to make a couple of plays. And just also when there are deflections, getting towards loose balls, he's had a little bit more verve in doing that. He's done a good job of just sticking his noses in help defense a little bit more to get some of those steals as well. I mean, he is such a smooth player that you're probably never going to see just those quick choppy feet, like manic effort from him like you do for a lot of guys. So again, I'm not willing to say that he is for sure turned some kind of a corner. I mean, they're still not defending at some amazing rate over the last, and not that good with he and Towns on the floor either for the season or lately, but it is an encouraging sign that he's beginning to make more use of his physical tools.
Encouraging is exactly the word I was going to use. And also, as somebody who covered Monte Ellis, people who were relying on steals as the proof that he was better on defense is that's always a red flag but these are more positive ones. Yeah,
exactly. Right. The one thing I wanted to see is they're not Monte Ellis, Allen Iverson style gambles where you miss it and then you give up a layup as a result. You know, I mean, obviously that's not going to show up when I'm just watching all of his steals, but if every single one of his steals was gambling out in the passing lane, then you can assume he's probably missing a bunch of them too. Those weren't those type of plays. It's just getting into the right help position, pressuring the ball properly, and then taking judicious gambles every once in a while. So we'll see if that continues or not. We're going to get to New Orleans momentarily. Actually, we just had a podcast yesterday with Justin Verrier talking about them in great detail, but I wanted to get Danny's thoughts and get some more of my research in too. But first, this from Hubble Contacts. I do not wear contacts, so I actually was interested to hear about them because my girlfriend does. She has complained about her contacts being so uncomfortable. She does the contacts that last for 2 weeks because that's less expensive than getting new ones every day. But with Hubble now, you can get a fresh pair of lenses every single day for $30 a month. So that's $1 a day. And that's half the price of other brands. Why are they able to do it so inexpensively? Well, if you go to the optometrist, he gets a little cut of it. There's a distributor who gets a little cut of it. There's probably some sort of marketing involved as well. And then the manufacturer as well. There are some crazy profit margins in this industry, frankly, because this is a commodity, right? Like, yeah, it's in your eyes. It requires a prescription. You go through the optometrist. But if you're actually making the contact, that doesn't cost that much to do, right? So now Hubble is taking some of those profits out of all of these middlemen in the industry and putting them right back in your hands. As I said, I don't know anything about contacts. I just got my girlfriend's prescription. Took me 3 minutes basically to order these contacts, even knowing nothing about how contacts work. 2 weeks later, they arrived. She's trying them. She's loving having a fresh pair of contacts every day. And if you're concerned somehow that these contacts aren't as good as the ones that you're paying way too much for through your optometrist, they're basically the exact same thing. These contacts have 20% of the Japanese market. There's a study done at the University of Houston Optometry School that said these contacts are the same in terms of both visual acuity and comfort. So get started with them, HubbleContacts.com. They'll give you your first 2 weeks of lenses for free. That's 15 pairs of lenses for free. You cannot beat that deal. Give them a shot. Go to HubbleContacts.com, 2020 vision for half the price. That's H-U-B-B-L-E, contacts.com. Alrighty, where are the New Orleans Pelicans?
25-40, 15 games under 500, 6-11 since the last time we covered them, 27th in offense, 7th in defense, negative 2.8 net rating, and they're projected to be 13th in the West by 538, 31 wins. And I'm going to be very interested to see the splits and just kind of how the season goes. Of course, they made the huge trade with DeMarcus Cousins. So far, Davis and Cousins playing together, they have a negative 4.9 net rating. Of course, that's not that many minutes, just 9 games so far that they've both played in because DeMarcus Cousins has already been suspended. And
yeah, oh, you know, and he just got fined $50,000 for yep. 2 separate instances of inappropriate language directed towards fans in their last 2 Rhodes games at the Lakers and at Utah.
One of the things that I'm going to be watching for the Pelicans the rest of the year, and we will have a big issue here in terms of sample and sample size and all of that representativeness, but before they got DeMarcus Cousins, the Pelicans had the number 3 clutch defensive rating in the entire NBA. They were allowing 95.1 points per 100 possessions during that time. I want to see how that moves during this, what it looks like afterwards, what units they play and everything else like that, because you can succeed in a wide variety of ways in the NBA. But the Pelicans had a little bit of a template. They figured it out later in the year, but they had a little bit of a template, whether it made Anthony Davis happy or not. And I want to see whether that continued.
Yeah, that being Davis at center, playing great defense and kind of scraping by on offense. Now, they've hit a terrible time to be way off shooting the ball. As Justin Verrier noted in his article earlier this week, they're shooting 21% on open threes since the trade and 30% from three overall. Solomon Hill and Hollis Thompson, the starting wings, basically the guys who are supposed to be spotting up from outside, 21% from three. Drew Holiday has been way off as well. So they might be looking a lot better if they just made the open three-point shots that some of these guys are generating. We know that some of their three-point shooting is gone with Caspi. When they go with Tim Frazier as the backup point guard, he can't shoot at all either. He's a nice player, but he needs more shooting around them, which they just cannot provide. They really don't have anyone who's a good shooter now on the wing with the demise of Caspi. So they might look a lot better. On the other hand, they've looked pretty bad with Cousins on the floor, with Cousins and AD together, as you mentioned, and they just didn't have the time. They're 2-6 since the trade happened, 1-6 with Cousins in the lineup. That one win was at the Tanktastic Lakers and they barely beat them. So it just hasn't worked so far. They are out of the playoffs right now, but it's just not really going to be possible for them, I don't think, to tank.
It runs into 2 big problems. So one is the structural incentive. Since they traded their pick top 3 protected to the Kings, they can improve their odds of keeping it, but they're not going to get into the 3 worst records. And that's really what you're looking for when thinking about tanking to protect a pick. There are a series of examples of this, Miami doing it, Golden State in 2012, various examples. So you have that incentive issue, but also they have Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. Like, they have better talent than some of the teams that they're going to be facing. So I expect them to just kind of play it as it lies. And the perverse incentive, you could say, for the Pelicans is that they have talent when they're healthy, but their guys don't always stay healthy. And so they can be judicious if somebody gets hurt with bringing them back.
Yeah, AD has this wrist contusion. I think it'll be interesting to see whether he plays or not. I looked a little bit more into how Cousins has been playing. The one stat that stuck out to me is he was complained about a lot in Sacramento that he just wouldn't roll hard to the basket, right? And if you think about it from DeMarcus's perspective, number one, you're kind of tired all the time when you're on the court. He's not in great shape. Number two, rolling to the basket is generally a selfless act, that you're rolling to the basket, you're probably going to get the ball maybe 1 out of every 10 times that you roll hard to the basket, because that's just what the defense is trying to take away, right? They're not going to just give you a layup unless something really goes wrong or a great pass is made by the point guard to get the ball to you. You're opening things up for somebody else. And for Cousins, when you're not in great shape, rolling to the basket time and time again, it just seems like this is not an efficient use of my energy. It might actually be in real life, but from his his standpoint, like, he's not getting the ball, so, you know, it's probably not worth it to roll. So that's continued now in New Orleans. He has used 25 possessions since the trade as a roll man. On 24 of those possessions, he is popped. So he's just not rolling to the basket at all. And everyone, you know, he'll pick and pop and then try to drive on the closeout. He'll do that, you know, maybe a third of the time or so. And that's, you're still getting penetration that way. That's better. It's not that he's just like, all he wants to do is shoot jumpers, but he wants to get the ball. And that's why he plays that way. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, we're like, oh, hey, they're going to tank. We're assuming they're going to start playing better. I mean, if they just keep going, winning 1/7 of their games, they'll be tanking just fine with Cousins around. I still think they will probably do a little bit better, though.
I would think so, but it's never completely sure. So, yeah, I'd be, I'm wondering where we're going to, you know, say it's 2 weeks that from when we do this, like where that team is going to be at that point, just because there's so much variability in it. And over the next little while, they're playing a lot of these kind of like fringy teams. So they play Charlotte and Portland and Miami and Minnesota. So like those games, I mean, could go either way.
I think they're underdogs in all those games to me.
Yeah, probably.
Even at home, I think the way they've been playing right now.
So yeah, we'll have to see. And then towards the end of the month, they play Dallas and Sac. So maybe they can, I mean, Dallas is playing well right now, so they're probably underdogs in that game too. But again, it could just be a circumstance where they're not trying to tank, but they're just not better than the teams they're playing.
Yeah, and if they lose a majority of those games, then maybe really they'll start to understand. But again, you know, remember even Alvin Gentry in the second year of a 3-year deal, not a ton of money. Even if Dell Demps may have saved his job, Gentry could be the fall guy for this not going well. They know they'll have one more season with Cousins. They can't mess around if they don't think the coach is doing well. So Gentry is going to be trying to win because he wants to prove that they've at least turned around and he deserves another year. So there are a lot of dueling incentives here.
Wait, before we move on, can I make one small little tirade? I hadn't noticed this until now. In the last
tirade? Isn't that an oxymoron?
It's close. In the last 2.5 weeks of the season, the Pelicans play the Nuggets 3 times. That should not happen. That's just competitive balance garbage. No team should ever face an opponent that frequently in a specific time, especially the last couple weeks of the year, which are non-representative. It's not fair for either team or for the Western Conference, for the teams, if they're tanking, competing against Denver for that last spot.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that can go wrong there, whether they're one of the teams is tanking, whether there's just an injury with a guy for 2 weeks and one team gets to benefit. I agree with you that spreading things out should be a little bit better. Now, the league generally has loaded up on so-called good games in the end of the year because that's when there's more of a focus on the league. That's when they want to save their best matchups for when the best TV ratings are available. So I understand that if it's really about making money, but I think that's something where at least spread it out over like a 2-month period or something.
It's not like Pelicans Nuggets is one of those games. I can understand it a little bit more with Spurs Warriors.
If you're going to have, lots of good matchups, then by definition, you're going to have a lot of quote unquote bad matchups as well. And this would be certainly from a viewership standpoint, a bad matchup.
Yeah, probably.
One more thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. I was going to change the subject. Well, you want me to change the subject or are you still on that subject?
Yes, I do.
Lost in all of these fireworks in New Orleans. Donatas Mata-Yunas has not been good. 9.3 PER in 367 minutes, under 500 true shooting, turning it over on 19.4% of his possessions. He has been really not playing very much now that Cousins has arrived, which makes perfect sense. He's not really a great fit with Cousins. They need to go a little bit smaller around him when, and obviously Cousins and AD play together. So that fit really was never that great to me to begin with for Demo. He's on a minimum contract right now. Maybe he could get something like, you know, somebody's room exception if he's lucky this offseason. Maybe not even that. It's not looking good there. Oh, and one other thing I want to talk about too with Cousins that reminded me of this is his fouling is a real problem in a number of ways. I mean, one, just that he's not on the court and it messes up the team's rhythm. And there's that aspect of it. But also when he gets in foul trouble, he gets particularly hopeless defensively. He's not one of these guys who's like really good at guarding and foul trouble, you know, and then he ends up fouling out of a lot of games anyway. He's committed by far the most fouls in the league, as I recall. So it's just really this compounding problem where he fouling is bad. It causes the other team to shoot free throws. And then he's not on the court. And then when he is on the court, he just continues to give very little effort and not contest shots or move his feet in the pick and roll, and things get worse defensively as well. So that's another reason why, the returns have not really been there for him. Let's move on to Oklahoma City.
The Thunder are 35-29, 7-9 since the last 15-60, 20th in offense, 12th in defense, slightly negative 1.1 net rating. 538 projects them to finish 7th in the West with 44 wins. Do you want the Russell Westbrook stat dump now or later?
Well, I think it's good to get on it. His usage is crazy. 41.5%, that would be an NBA record. 55% true shooting, which is above league average. 30 PER, which is number one in the league, number four in RPM, number two in offensive RPM, and quite understandable. I mean, the thing about him, oh yeah, his team is not winning games, or like his 58-point game the other day, people were like, oh, this is such an empty 58-point game, and he did struggle a little bit down the end of that game. But nonetheless, they were positive when he was on the floor, and they're positive with him on the floor so far this year. It's just his backups are so, so awful, and he shouldn't be penalized for that. I mean, he gets a little bit of a boost probably in RPM because his backups are so bad. But nonetheless, he's having a wonderful season. They're good when he's on the court, and it's not like they have anybody else on this team who can score. And even when he has to have a 58% usage like he did in the 58-point game, and that doesn't even include his assists, where he had 9 assists, or his potential assists, you know, like, this style has been effective. I mean, it's not going to be effective at the absolute highest levels, but he doesn't play like this when there's actually, you know, even when he had KD on the team or other scorers. And remember, Victor Oladipo has been out these last six games too.
You brought up the bad backups, which is certainly a fair point, but also broadly speaking, they have ill-fitting players with him. Like, this isn't a circumstance like Harden where those guys make sense with James Harden. Like, they have built with coach, personnel, they have a system that makes sense, that everything fits together and is conducive to his success. Yes, you could argue that Russell Westbrook's surrounding talent in some ways can help certain elements of his stats, just because, especially like PER, if you are at a certain threshold of shooting effectiveness and you ramp up usage, that improves your PER. So Westbrook is getting that because he takes a lot of shots, but he's in many ways, especially in terms of team success, they're being hurt by that. So I'm not gonna knock him in that way for basically doing what is asked of him in a way that very few other people could do.
You talked about the bad backups. It's Samaje Christen and now Norris Cole, who have they gotten? Samaje is, and we talked about how bad they've been with those guys on the floor. Samaje Christen basically last in the league in RPM. Like, he's like bottom five. Norris Cole has had many, many years. He's coming back from China now, but many years to prove that he is a third point guard at the absolute best. Christen is shooting 33% from the field and 18% from three. And that's in like a pretty damn big sample of minutes too. You know, he was with Payne out for the first 2 months, he was really the main backup point guard, and now he has been again with Payne being traded. And then Cole, 52 minutes, negative 0.2 PER. He's 6 of 20 from the field. They have a 94 offensive rating with him on the court, which of course is well below worst in the league levels. So although they did make this trade, although they probably did win this trade with Chicago, and it's not like Payne has been awesome in Chicago either, the guys they have now at backup point guard are such a downgrade from what Payne gave them. And maybe now, you know, if Oladipo comes back, he'll just be the backup point guard, and that can help solve the problem. But whenever Christen or Cole are on the court, they're just swimming so hard upstream.
It's also taken away Jeremy Grant's ability to play power forward, which I thought he'd looked better during that time. But they did improve in terms of talent in the trade, but I do think that's an astute point about how it changes their structure. One other thing I wanted to mention, just because it's another part of this team story and the Westbrook story, is that they're, even after the loss to the Blazers, they're still awesome in crunch time. 21-14 clutch record, number 8 winning percentage, but their plus 21.7 net rating is number 2. It was number 1 until the Spurs passed it yesterday. And so this is they've been great in that, and that is what is fueling their success. And so one of my broad points with them is, so okay, they're, you know, they're 20th in offense, they're 12th in defense, and their net rating, they're about flat overall, a little bit below. That's about what I expect. What's been different is that they've been absolute assassins in close games. Games, and that's pushed them a little bit higher in the conference, in the division, than I expect.
Yeah, and actually Russ being so ridiculous in the clutch, he's got that 61% clutch usage, and that's just the shots that he's taking. We're not even talking about the shots that he's setting up now with that. Which
is a 53.5% assist percentage.
Yeah, that's basically every bucket on that he is not scoring, he's assisting, because he's probably getting half of their buckets at least. So in clutch time, that actually belies guys, Russell Westbrook has generally been a pretty poor fourth quarter player up until this period. There's some speculation that maybe that's because he gets tired, but his usage and his effort has had to go up even higher. I will say this, Billy Donovan deserves credit for not playing him too many minutes. I think he's at like 35 minutes a game. And with how terrible the backups have been and how they get killed every time he leaves the floor, there's got to be a temptation to play him more. But I think it's paid off, number one, just to avoid injury and keep him fresh. But number two, the way he's been able to play and the burden he's been able to take on down the stretch of some of these games, probably wouldn't be able to do that if he were playing more minutes and were more tired. So I think that strategy, that level of discipline from Donovan has paid off to some degree. It's impossible to know exactly how much.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Let's talk a little bit about the players who were acquired in the trade. Doug McDermott not played well. He's 27 minutes a game in seven games, but he's shooting only 24% on threes. He have a -7 net rating when he's out there, in part because, you know, he doesn't play as many of his minutes with Westbrook. Taj Gibson also has not been that efficient. He's playing 23 minutes a game, 10.0 PER since the trade, -6.6 net rating. Again, not helped by the fact of playing less of his minutes with Westbrook. Sabonis still playing a lot, actually. I think in the game against the Blazers, he had 21 and was quite in the positive. Again, he plays with their starting lineup. He plays more with Russ. All that said, and he does provide just the illusion of spacing, if not actually hitting those shots. All that said, I think I probably would just be starting Gibson, go with a three-man big rotation of Cantor, Adams, and Gibson, and then you could throw in some of Jeremy Grant at power forward as well. But Sabonis is, of course, the apple of the organization's eye. He's still been getting the Keith Bogan start, but I do think that they are missing an opportunity there. I mean, Taj Gibson is just so much better than Sabonis is, as is Cantor, as probably really is Grant, that to play Sabonis, even giving him the Keith Bogans, is probably not a smart move if you're really trying to win games right now. Whether developing him helps, I think they're probably looking like they're going to be either the sixth or the seventh seed. It's not really, I don't see a huge difference between those, but in the playoffs, I mean, they're going to start Sabonis. He's not going to be good, and they're really going to throw away their chance of some of the minutes with Westbrook on the floor.
Yeah, I think they pretty much separated the 4 and 5, something you and I had talked about that we thought would happen. The Jazz and the Clippers have separated from the Grizzlies and Thunder a little bit. It's now 3 games between Oklahoma City and the Clippers, who are 5. And I disagree with you that I do think there's a meaningful difference between 7 and 6, because at 7, you're facing the Warriors or the Spurs, and at 6, you're facing the Rockets. The Rockets are a very good team, but I think that they would have a better chance, even just on variance, in that series than they would against either the Warriors or the Spurs.
That's an interesting question of who they match up against, whether it's better, whether it's the Spurs. I actually think they might match up better against the Spurs because they have a ton of guys that they can throw at Kawhi Leonard. It's going to be tough for them to score, but Russ can just kind of create enough. I think they actually have a pretty decent chance at stopping them, whereas Houston, I think, is going to spread them out. They're going to try to go to this bully ball. Guys like Gibson or Cantor are just going to like really get taken advantage. I mean, that's one of the big things too, is that against the Spurs, Cantor can stay on the floor. They're going to play that's two right. bigs. Cantor was enormous in that series last year. Whereas against Houston, I don't know who Cantor is going to guard. I think it could be a total disaster. I think the Spurs are a better team than the Rockets, you know, obviously during the regular season, but I also think that, what were you going to say?
Well, I'm also not totally sure that the Spurs are going to be the team that the Thunder would face if they get the 7 seed. We'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah, no, that's after last night's loss to and another crazy Spurs comeback. I mean, they've had a bunch of those. Yeah, we will talk about that more. We'll get to Phoenix momentarily, but first, this from ZipRecruiter. When I worked as a lawyer, part of what I had to do was to determine who we might want to hire. And I really had no idea how to go about that. Right there, I was like, oh, we want to post on Craigslist? That doesn't really seem like the best way. This is like a legal job, isn't Craigslist like kind of where you're going to go sell furniture or like, you know, tickets or something? But we actually like got some decent candidates off of Craigslist. Or are we gonna, is there, you know, should we advertise in like the local publication for lawyers? You know, what should we do? I wish I'd had ZipRecruiter at that time, because ZipRecruiter posts your job on all the top job sites. They already have 9 million resumes in their database that you can search through. If you're just working in an organization in HR, you can add multiple people to your account. So it's really efficient for your team. You can post your job to 200 plus job sites, social media networks like Twitter and Facebook, and then you can screen them all right in the app as well and hire the right person fast. You don't have to log into a bunch of different sites anymore. You don't have to juggle email emails or calls to your office. And you can also get their friendly and human support staff to help out as well if you run into any issues. Right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us as well. That's ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/capspace. Phoenix Suns.
21-43, 6-11 since last time we did this. 19th in offense, another team that jumped three spots, like because when we kind of take delays in this, they jumped three spots during that, I think. 26th in defense, -4.6 net rating, projected to be 14th in West with 28 wins.
Yeah, they too are right in this tankathon right now, a little bit below some of these other teams. I think the chances of them catching the Lakers for the number two seed in the lottery are pretty low at this point with how the Lakers are playing. They've been playing better. At one point, they won three straight. They've had some moments where they, you know, some nice wins against San Antonio on the road, against Toronto, those type of games. And I think it's possible that they could actually get knocked back in the lottery because some of these teams right around them, I think the Magic, the Sixers, both of them are falling pretty quickly here, and they're only projected to be a couple of games worse than them. They're projected to have a better point differential than either the Sixers or Magic as well. So we could see them dropping down to the fifth seed, I think, pretty easily. They're probably safe from the Knicks or the Pels. The Kings also will be in massive free fall, and the Kings are four games ahead of them. So it would be tough for the Kings to catch them, but I think they certainly will try or should try.
And also, Phoenix, not only did they win three games in a row recently, Charlotte, OKC, Boston, all at home, they've had some big home wins, interestingly, just throughout the season, but they face a lot of bad teams in the remaining stretch of the season. They face the Lakers again, they face the Kings twice, they face the Magic, they face the Nets. Like, if they win most or all of those games, they're going to start jumping these teams.
Yeah, that game against the Magic will be a big one as well. Wanted to talk about a few more macro things with them. You put in here how we would rate the PJ Tucker trade for them. My answer to that is better than New Orleans for Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon last year. I mean, at some point, you put a guy on the market. He's going to be a free agent. He's 31 years old. You're probably not going to bring him back. You have a lot of guys at that position that you want to develop. They wanted a first round pick. They held out for it. They just didn't have enough competition in the marketplace to get that. So yeah, you know, they got 2 seconds that are probably not going to be that great from Toronto, but they got something. And so I mean, if that's what the best offer was, they got the best offer. And so I would rate it positively for them because, and he was a winning player too. So now you can develop these young guys. You can also probably lose more games. I mean, it's a win-win. I would rate it very well for them just because I mean, unless I had some evidence that they had a better offer that they didn't take, which of course I'm sure wasn't the case, then I think they did fine.
Something is certainly better than nothing. And with second round picks, they don't really carry any burden. So if you know, for whatever reason there isn't anybody you like, then you could just trade it or let it go. Not a big deal. And what I don't love about this is that I personally don't value second round picks in the bottom 10 very much, like, you know, 51 to 60. And it's entirely possible that the Raptors pick doesn't fall into that range. Maybe it's, you know, 48 or something like that this year, depending on how their season goes.
Yeah. And so they have next year's too, right?
Right.
It's this year's and next
year. I believe
year. So
it's
next
year's.
Who knows
year
what happens with the Raptors?
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
So I would rather, just as a personal preference thing, have one higher second than have kind of two bites at the late first apple, but it's not a huge difference. The one option that was on the table for them, especially considering they later made they needed to acquire like kind of filler salary to get to the four, is if they had an option of trading him for somebody with a little bit more salary that maybe that other team didn't want, or something like what the Lakers did to get a first for Corey Brewer. It's actually what I did in the mock offseason, you know, working with that. I think I was the Rockets in that deal. I gave up a first, but I also had them take on Brewer. I would have preferred that as the Suns to what they got, but it's not a huge
difference. Yeah, but who needed PJ Tucker, I think, at this point is the question, that would have given them a better offer than Toronto would have.
Yeah, Cleveland didn't really have the means at this point, unless they were going to. Would you rather have Chetty Osman than those seconds, if theoretically, if that were on the table?
Probably, but I don't think that was on the table. And then they would have had to
Korver trade.
Right. I mean, they what salary was were they going to take back? And then there were some more luxury tax implications as well. Cleveland was more focused on the buyout market. They'd already made the Korver trade, so I really don't think that the market for PJ just dried up. I mean, maybe you could say Boston, but I don't know that PJ is like so much of an upgrade over Jonas Jerebko. They've got a lot of guys who are kind of like that. Maybe he would have helped them a little bit, but I don't think that Boston was making like a huge play. And the other problem too is that Tucker has bird rights, but Boston can't keep his cap hold on the books because they are going to try to use cap space and free agency. So those bird rights didn't mean anything to Boston either. So I think they did okay. The other question that you posited, which I think is good, outside of Devin Booker, who is the best prospect on this team?
I'm still a believer in Dragan Bender. I think it's him. And especially, are you counting TJ Warren as a prospect at this point?
Sure.
I'd still say
he's only a third-year player. I mean, if you're on your rookie contract and you're pretty young, I think, I mean, especially because he missed that time early on. I mean, TJ actually has come on a little bit. I think he's shown some growth defensively. I think he can do a little bit more.
He's only 23. Chris, I mean, it's still basically the same boat. It's like if he figures it out, then great. If he doesn't figure it out.
He's been almost exactly what I expected from him. I would have hoped that he could shoot the ball a little bit better this year. I mean, I guess he's at 32% on threes, 36% on long twos. That's not a huge surprise. Adjusting to the line. He actually, one thing about Chris that's interesting is he's only shooting 59% at the rim, which you would hope would be a lot better. I mean, he gets a lot of these dunks, but on non-dunks, he struggles and he hasn't really been able to do much efficiently from any range outside of that. So, and he's shooting only 44% from the field. One of the things about Chris is, you know, what is he defensively? Can he guard anybody who's a stretch four? Can he switch at all? I don't know. And obviously his basketball intelligence has never been something that he's had a great reputation for. And I've not seen much to dispute that he fouls a ton. He's definitely being gifted these starting minutes right now. So it's, I think he could be good, but a lot of that path even has kind of closed off to me because he hasn't really outstripped expectations here in this first year.
And our expectations were not exactly high. You know,
I think he was the right pick at number eight for sure. I actually liked that trade for them. I think he has some potential. He seems like very Derek Williams-y right now.
That must hurt you as an Arizona alum.
I started to become a fan of them my first year there. And my first year there was when they blew the 15-point lead to Illinois in the last 5 minutes of the regional final. And I was like,
that was an awesome game.
Yeah, it was. But I, at that point, I was like, you know what? I'm too old to really like develop some huge new allegiance here. And so I'm glad that I felt that way because they've had some like really ugly losses in like the last like 5 or 6 years regional finals to not get to the final four. So you still think it's Bender? I mean, I think it's got to be either Bender or Warren. How good is Devin Booker? Like, how good do we think he's going to be? Just real briefly, I think I don't know if I see him as like even necessarily the second best player on a very good team. Would you agree with that? Do you think there's? Now, I'm not saying he can't get there, but I'm saying his most likely outcome. Would you see it the same way?
I would, especially because he has done a little bit better with the ball in his hands than I expected, which has been great. But he's still, you know, last year he shot 34% from three. This year he's at 37. 37 is good, but it's not.
Yeah.
Crazy elite. You know, you're not sitting there going, oh my God, like how do we get the ball in this guy's hands more? And also he continues to absolutely suck on defense. So his value outside of what he does well has grown a little bit, but it hasn't grown in a way that is necessarily encouraging to me that he will become this well-rounded player by his mid-20s.
Let's get to Portland.
Yeah. Portland, 27-35, 6-7 since the last time we did this, 12th in offense, 27th in defense, negative 1.9 net rating. So worse than the Wolves by more than 2 points per 100 possessions. They have a 41% chance of making the playoffs, which is actually in this one of these anomalies. They have better odds on 538 than Denver, but have a lower projected record. They're projected to be ninth with 37 wins.
4-3 since acquiring Yusuf Nurkic. And that trade has been going very well for them. 10.5 net rating with him on the court in 204 minutes in those games, so he's playing almost 30 minutes a game. They've been getting a few more offensive rebounds with him on the court, though he himself has not gotten a ton. Also interesting are just some of his box score stats.
Yeah, so he's playing 29 minutes a game in the seven games, 14.9 points, 55% field goal percentage, 8 rebounds, 4 assists, which is mind-blowing, 1.3 blocks, and 5 free throw attempts. So like that, you know, obviously there's defense and a lot of other things that are important for centers, but that's not a bad line.
Yeah, and the defensive rating with him on the floor against so much noise, you know, teams could have just missed 5 wide open three-pointers and it changes this whole calculation in such a small sample. But 104.5 defensive rating when he's on the court, that's not bad. 60% true shooting, that's fantastic. 50% free throw rate as well. And the hilarious thing about this is, you know, Plumlee is like supposedly this unbelievable passer and like that really is open everything up. He has a higher assist rate in Portland than Plumlee had with them. And he's been way better, I think, than Plumlee was for them. He doesn't provide that alley-oop finishing, and he's still like his biggest problem is that he has a landline.
I love that we get to make the about how old you are, but I'm the one that has a landline that periodically goes off.
Yeah, actually, I was listening to David Locke's podcast before he came on, and his landline went off during his show, too. This is really, landline day. His biggest problem is that he has no explosion around the basket. And so a lot of times, if he doesn't have his shoulder into the guy, he can get blocked, or he'll try to just throw it up before it gets blocked, and he'll have some really ugly attempts that'll just, like, sail over the basket in ugly fashion. But he generates so many attempts close to the basket that even though he's a little bit below average on finishing those attempts, he generates enough of them that those are still high value shots. He gets a lot of dump offs. He's been rolling to the basket quite a bit as well. He's got great hands, good touch when he's open. He'll finish offensive rebounds, can create some shots in the post as well. So 23% usage for him and 60% true shooting, even though he'll have some ugly ones, in the aggregate, it works out for him.
They don't have a ton of options to get better at center just because they're so deeply, deeply capped out. But do you think that he is better than realistically what they can get? Let's say they throw their full taxpayer mid-level exception at one guy. Do you think that Nurkic will be better than that and thus presumably be their starter next year?
I don't know, but the early returns are very encouraging. And if I were them, I would be looking for someone who can hit a shot and play power forward, or even, you know, maybe a backup center, because I guess they'll still have Ed Davis. They'll still have Plumlee, or I'm sorry, they'll still have Myers Leonard.
Same thing.
The black sheep Plumlee brother, because he shoots threes and has a better tan. But yeah, I don't know. I think he, considering the low cost, especially, this was a great buy. And they also got that first rounder as well out of the deal. And from Denver's standpoint, it must chap them a little bit to see him playing this way, because they would have loved for him to just play this way as a backup center. But he played so selfishly there. He checked out just... And they wasted, this is after they wasted 20 games of the season trying to appease him by putting him in the starting lineup and getting him to be checked in. That obviously didn't work with Jokic, but he's been good when he hasn't been injured. He was good as a rookie, and he's been good this year. Still has a few problems where he'll like try to post up against guys that he's not good enough to post up against. Like his attempts to post up Steven Adams again in these two games they played against Oklahoma City have been high comedy. But when he gets a switch, he's very good. He had a key post up bucket late against Russell Westbrook, who, granted, Nurkic is a center, but Westbrook will compete hard and is not going to give up post position easily, especially late in the game. That's a dimension that Plumlee didn't provide at all. And I think defensively, still, as the quick feet, you noted that good defensive rating. I think that he's got good length. He's a good defensive rebounder. I think he's much better on the glass than Plumlee on both ends. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be pretty hilarious if, number one, the trade that Denver made to worsen Portland by taking Plumlee away from them actually ends up helping Portland beat out Denver, and Portland gets a first round pick for their trouble, and they get to pay way less for Nurkic next year than Denver's going to have to pay Plumlee.
Yeah, it's one of those circumstances, you know, but it, yeah, I mean, Portland, I think, did a better job identifying talent. And you have to value guys. This was an issue with the Denver trade that got rationalized. I love Adam Modest, but it was a very interesting disagreement that we had where he talked about how, like, Nurkic didn't have much value to them. And that's true. Very true. But he had value to other teams. And so Portland kind of got him at Denver's price, which made it a coup.
Yeah, I think that's true. Now, it's only been 7 games. Maybe Nurkic gets pissed off somehow and or next year he's not any good or you know, doesn't fit in chemistry wise or whatever, but he seems to be pretty happy there so far. Noah Vonleh somehow has a 15 net rating in his minutes since the trade, and Nurkic and Vonleh have been a successful combination. Again, I'm not willing to say that they're going to be this awesome combo going forward, but those guys are plus 40 in 104 minutes since the trade. I mean, you know, they haven't had the hardest schedule in the world, and generally their starting lineup with Harkless at the three and those two guys, Dame and CJ, has done pretty well. So I think I've been like a little higher on Portland's chances to get the eighth seed than a lot of people were, and it wouldn't shock me right now, especially because Denver lost a tough one at home yesterday with Jokic ill and Gallo ill. I mean, that was a game that they hopefully could have won. Who'd they play? Is it Charlotte?
No, it was against Washington.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so they got blown out there. And Charlotte, by the way, hey, Cody Zeller is back, and now they're good again. What a surprise.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's enough on the Hornets. I mean, Trailblazers. Let's get to Sacramento.
The Kings are 25-39, 6-11 since the last 15-60, 8th in offense, 24th in defense, negative 4.1 net rating, projected to be 12th in the West with 32 wins. And they had the absolute pièce de résistance yesterday, playing against the Spurs with no Kawhi, with no LaMarcus Aldridge. They go up huge in the first quarter and then lose by 10.
They blew a 28-point lead as well after, and then they also really should have beaten Utah the game before, so they are actually trying. I mean, those are two good teams that they were close against. I mean, like, to be honest, that's, well, it's nice to make fun of them for losing that lead. A competitive game in which they end up losing at the end is really perfect for this team. They won their first two without Cousins, of Boston and Denver games, have not won a game since then, I don't think. Where are they standing in the tankathon right now?
So it gets a little bit sticky in terms of just all the teams in their mix, but as I said, 538 projects them to finish 12th in the West, which means that they're kind of in that morass. So right now you kind of have this bottom group that I would say is the Nets and then the Lakers and then the Suns, Sixers, Magic, maybe all together. They're probably in that group with the Knicks and the Pelicans as well, so that would be in the range for the 6th through 8 picks. But any of those teams falling hard enough can get past them. I think they'll fall past New Orleans at the very minimum, but probably the Knicks too, because the Knicks are going to at least do their form of trying for the next little bit.
Yeah, right now they are a game and a half ahead of the Magic, but 2 games behind them in the loss column still. And I think the Magic can probably be expected to be a little friskier than the Kings going forward. If I had the Sixers are going to be really bad, and the Kings are 2.5 behind them as well, only 1 in the loss column. So I could see them getting as high as 4th. Like, that would be possible to me. But if I had to guess, it's probably more like 5th or 6th. I agree with you. I think the Knicks and the Pels will probably fail to out-tank them as
and
we
go on.
So they're looking
also
at least 6th.
Sacramento fans are probably sad enough already. It's not too much to add in. There's a reminder that the Sixers have basically the Kings ping pong balls. So they have a swap right, assuming that pick ends up in the top 10. And if they end up 3rd and 5th or something of that ilk, then basically the way it works is that the Sixers get those balls. But there's certainly a possibility that both teams win out in that and that the Kings get a really good pick anyway.
Wait, they have swap rights with the Sixers? When did that happen? What trade was that?
I nearly answered that seriously. I don't know why I got close, but I nearly answered that seriously. And I'm like, this is my thing.
What did we talk about that on the show before?
But we should talk about
the trade that we said was
about
the worst one since the lockout back in 2015. I mean, I think we said it was like the second worst, and that was like 2 months after it happened. It only looks worse now, right?
Yeah, because then it ended up happening where that locked into being the unprotected 2019 first round pick, and then they traded DeMarcus Cousins. But we should talk about a player that they took with a first round pick. Scal has looked good since they actually got him playing time after making the big trade.
Yeah, he's been playing exclusively at the four, in large part next to Willie Cauley-Stein. I mean, I think it would be great if he could be a center. He might not be tough enough to do that. He's had some blocks that have impressed me where he's just like pogo sticked off the ground. He doesn't have a ton of moves, but when he gets the ball, I described him when I first saw him at the Nike Hoop Summit in 2014. Is that 2014? No, it might have been 2015. Anyway, yeah, it was 2015. I described him as almost like a volleyball player playing basketball because he doesn't have a ton of ability to do anything off the dribble. But if he just gets the ball and jumps straight up and down, he's a great leaper and he's very comfortable just catching the ball and turning either with a jump hook, a dunk. If he's in position, he's got some nice quick springs, or really, I think what's going to be one of the foundations of his game is his jump shot, spotting up, or even he's had some nice plays where he'll take maybe one dribble at the most. He can go either shoulder with his turnaround jumper, and he's got a nice touch there. Now, whether he can defend long term at the power forward position, how smart he is defensively, all that stuff still remains to be seen, but there's something there, you know, and there always was something there with him. He hasn't played that well in the D League, but he's had some flashes. I think he had 14 against the Spurs in that game yesterday, a couple of nice dunks, a couple of nice blocks. So I'm encouraged by what we've seen from him. I think that he could potentially be something. I've always hoped that what he would be is a center who could shoot some threes and block some shots, and then also, you know, maybe post up a little bit on switches, do some pick and pops. I don't think he's ever going to play center on this Kings team because they still have a billion centers on the roster. But, you know, the fact that he's just been able to have some nice scoring games for the number 28 pick and what's been a horrible draft is very encouraging.
I am very interested in what they end up prioritizing in the draft once they get there. I mean, they'll probably do BPA just because they have so little established talent, but they're going to get somebody who will help. They just need a lot more pieces. And so maybe they, you know, end up moving Costa Kufos, and then that opens up minutes more at the five for Scal. There are a bunch of different other things they could do.
Dave Yeager, I don't think, he just doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's willing to play someone like that at center. I think I would be very shocked.
That's a fair point.
I mean, I would be very surprised if he plays hardly any minutes at center while Yeager is the coach. Let's talk a little bit about Buddy Hield. Looks like the same guy pretty much. His numbers are interesting since he's come over. 67% true shooting, that's good. 48% on threes, 24% usage, you know, that's a lot. He's been one of the primary guys scoring off the bench, turning it over on 24% of his possessions, which might indicate that he's being a little bit overextended. His pick and roll numbers are actually really good, but I don't see that continuing. Just a lot of long twos off the dribble. He's gotten to the rim more than expected. I mean, not some like awesome high value finishes. I mean, a lot of it's just been frankly on plays where the defense wasn't very good. I always felt like he could hit some shots and be a solid backup shooting guard and maybe a low end starter. I haven't seen a ton to change my opinion of that yet, even though he has done a few things with the ball in his hands. I mean, it's not like he's been exploding to the rim or really creating awesome separation or something. He's just kind of been hitting some difficult long twos, and it's possible that he will get so good at those that he can really be effective that way, but I think it's pretty unlikely, especially because he shoots the set shot that takes him a little bit to get off the dribble. And so I think even if he can really make those shots consistently, creating those shots is going to be more difficult for him.
And he's also going to get the chance to really show it next year, because it's prohibitively unlikely that the Kings either are going to use their cap space or draft pick in a way that will block him, unless they end up taking Malik Monk, which would be way too funny.
Yeah, another Kentucky guy. What a surprise with the Kings. San Antonio, let's get to them.
Yeah, big week for them. 50-13, 14-2 since the last time we did this. Fifth in offense, first in defense, +9 net rating. And over the last couple days, their chances of getting the top seed in the West have risen to 29%, 25% title odds, projected to finish second in the West with 64 wins.
Yeah, and that 29% chance of the top seed doesn't even note that Kevin Durant's been on. I mean, I'm sure it realizes that the Warriors haven't been playing as well, but you still have all this time with Durant that's changing that. It's very interesting. You noted that they have the best clutch net rating now. Is that right this year?
Yes, they jumped the Thunder after the in both total net rating and defensive rating after their game yesterday.
Yeah, and they had that crazy game against Houston where Kawhi had that sequence. They beat Minnesota in overtime over the weekend. They came back against Sacramento from 28 down. I think they had another close win that I can't recall off the top of my head right before that Minnesota game. And amazing how things have flipped, where the Warriors now are no good in the clutch. The Warriors were the best clutch team ever last year. The Spurs were actually kind of a disappointment in the clutch last year. Their point differential actually was better than their record for most of the season until they kind of packed it in late. So that's kind of, maybe that'll be one of the big differences. I don't know how real that is, you know, compared to the Warriors clutch performance not being real. But yeah, I mean, I think this game on Saturday is going to be huge. If the Warriors lose that, they also will have lost the season series to the Spurs, and the Spurs will have the inside track. And you have to say the Spurs, especially with the Warriors coming off of back-to-back, will be, and the way they've been playing, are pretty big favorites in that one.
I agree with you. And we'll be doing that for the Twitter NBA show Second Screen. Nice little promo for that. And my instinct is that the Spurs are going to start really pushing for the number one seed, not in terms of their own effort, but just because they're healthier and they're deeper than the Warriors are right now. And they can just, if they start running off some wins, they have, after the game against Oklahoma City tonight, we're recording this on Thursday, they have 3 home games in a row that'll all be winnable but challenging, and then they don't face really a truly strong team again until Cleveland March 27th. So if they just keep on tacking on wins and the Warriors lose once or twice, then this starts to get to that point, and then they play again right at the end of the month.
With all that said, I am still skeptical of this team in the playoffs.
So am I.
In part perhaps because of their performance against Oklahoma City last year, and even maybe the year before, though Kawhi Leonard was not Kawhi Leonard back then. Kawhi even is way better than he was last year, and he, despite the fact that they lost, he wasn't the reason they lost. He had a great playoffs against Oklahoma City. I think he's going to be pretty good in the playoffs. But this idea of Parker playing in crunch time, and again, they have this great clutch net rating, as you noted, I still am skeptical of their ability to score against really good defenses in crunch time. LaMarcus Aldridge, one of the reasons is that he has not been an efficient option going one-on-one this year. And there was a time when you were like, all right, we can't get stuck with somebody on him who he's just going to torch every time. And now really his post-ups, he's just not getting the separation that he used to on that turnaround jumper. I mean, when he backs in, he can get to a hook shot. He's still very effective, but his true shooting is below the league average. Whether he's going right shoulder or left shoulder, it seems like he has to rush his shot just a little bit more against most defenders. He also has not been hitting his pick and pop jumpers. He's only in the 36th percentile percentage in shooting jumpers off the pick and pop. So I think, especially because they've won a lot of these squeakers lately, because I just don't think, I mean, I think if they had more spacing around Kawhi, then maybe you could say that, you know, they're going to be efficient just with him. But there are a lot of ways to double Kawhi with Parker. Aldridge is not shooting enough threes. He shoots well on threes, but he needs to shoot more of them. If they have Gasol on the floor, you can go at Gasol defensively. If it's Deadman, he's okay, but I think not a guy that you're like deathly afraid of as a role man. And so then you're just back to Danny Green as the only spot up threat. When they actually get the spot ups, as you noted, they're hitting them great. They're at 1.09 points per possession, but they still just don't get enough of those shots. They don't get penetration. They don't really get a ton of assists. I just think all of that is going to grow too predictable in the playoffs. And then they also, while their defense is great in the regular season, I think they have Aldridge, Gasol being the two, Parker to some extent, if he's going to guard a larger player, I think they have some ways that they can be exploited defensively. So it all works great. The cohesion is amazing. They never screw up. But in the playoffs, when you're really locked in, I think that they're a worse team.
As a time capsule, because I think we're going to talk about this a lot in probably about a month, would you rather, if you were the Spurs, would you rather face the Rockets in the second round or the winner of a theoretical Jazz Clippers series?
I think they feel very comfortable against the Jazz. They've historically played them very well, although obviously this is a much better Jazz team than some of the previous, but Gobert, Hayward, some of the players are the same. The Clippers, the Spurs, I think, beat them in Paul's first game back. The Clippers, when they're rolling, killed the Spurs early in the season. I also don't think that Houston is a great matchup for the Spurs as well. I don't know. I think if they match up, they'll have home court, which would help against both those teams. I think you would rather probably just get the first seed, number one, so that you have home court advantage against the Warriors. That's going to be essential if the Warriors even get that far, which they probably will, but we're probably a little too skies falling on them right now. But if it were on a neutral floor, I think against the Clippers or Houston, I would not make the Spurs very significant favorites if favorites at all.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I still haven't fully processed how I feel about it, but I think it's pretty close to that.
All right, last one, Utah Jazz.
41-24, 11-5 since the last one, 13th in offense, 3rd in defense, plus 5.2 net rating, projected 538 to be 4th in the West with 51 wins.
Yeah, they got a big win yesterday on the road against Houston with George Hill out, with Derek Favors out, although a good game for Favors to rest given the way Houston plays. And Houston also was missing Ryan Anderson in that game. You noted a really good stat about the way that they defend the pick and roll.
So in term, I like to look at both, as you do too, look at both frequency and effectiveness. And they have the highest opponent pick and roll ball handler frequency and the highest opponent dribble handoff frequency, which is pretty much, as I can tell it, just teams trying to get Gobert out of the paint.
Well, I interpret that a slightly different way. And I mean, so that percentage, 20% of the shots basically or possessions taken by possessions isn't quite right, because synergy, if you get an offensive rebound and go back up, it counts that as another possession. It's not the same as just like the pure possession counts. But for the pick and roll ball handler to take 20% of the team shots, that's great. You want them largely doing that because it's usually not going to be a layup. And a lot of times it's going to be an inefficient 1-2 or an off the dribble 3 that not a lot of guys can make. And generally the league-wide average on those shots is about 0.8 points per possession, which of course is horrible. The average in the half court for most teams is a little bit over 0.9, probably maybe a little higher than that this year since offense is up. So I think it's the result of the Jazz strategy much more than other teams' strategies, because, and there was a perfect example of this last night against Houston. They held down Houston's three-pointers. The Jazz, I think, give up like the least corner threes in the league or close to it. And that's because they have Rudy Gobert, so they can play the pick and roll 2-on-2. They also have good defenders, guys like George Hill, who can get over the screen, compete from behind, force it into a slightly uncomfortable long two. And then nobody wants to actually go in and challenge Gobert. Gobert is also a master at playing the angles between the roll man and the driver, so it's hard to dime up the roll man as well. And I think it's much more about just, I agree with you, it's good to get Gobert out of the paint sometimes, but I think it's more just that that's the shot that Utah is giving up, and it's all because of their defensive personnel.
I think it's both. I think you're probably right in terms of Utah's system, but I think that a lot of it starts with the teams wanting the Jazz, like wanting that, and then the Jazz saying, okay, of this option, this is what we want.
So they've pulled ahead now. Memphis and the Thunder have both lost a bunch. I mean, they're looking likely to, even the Clippers are not playing that well. They're definitely playing the best out of any of those teams in the 4-7 range. That could change. This has been an inconsistent team. It's also been a subject of some consternation that they have the worst record they have the worst record against over 500 teams of teams that are all over 500. I think they're now like 11-15 against such teams, but I don't know how much I put into that. I think that could be random variation to some degree. Also just the fact that they played a lot of those teams when they were pretty injured for the first 2 months of the year. It is a concern that George Hill still is struggling with this toe issue and has had to miss games that they really are trying to win. That's a concern. I mean, this has been now lingering for, he missed like 15 games, and like the fact that it's not healed is certainly an issue. And you think also when that's going on, he can just aggravate it again at any time and have to miss games. You know, that's definitely a concern. I mean, it seems like the type of thing he can tough through in the playoffs, but you know, again, if he has this lingering injury, it makes me kind of wonder why he didn't take the renegotiation and extension. But let's say now that they re-sign Gordon Hayward and George Hill, what are things going to look like for their salary structure going forward? Hayward is going to re-sign at the max. He'll be making $31 million. And we'll assume maybe Hill would get like $25 million a year to start. It seems like a decent guess.
Yeah, something in that range, especially now that you can't get the surplus of paying him, you know, like paying him this season for next season.
Yeah, so where does that leave them from a potential tax standpoint?
It's very interesting, you know, when you really start to kind of push it out, because they're all their guys are going to get expensive as well. Because when you think about the chronology of the Jazz, so Gordon Hayward and George Hill pushing into it, so that makes them, let me look, I think that makes them relatively close, yeah, to the tax. Yeah, like it kind of pushes them, depending on what they want to do with Joe Ingles, who's also going to get paid, they'll be, I would say yeah, they'll kind
a,
of be
a restricted free agent, by the right. way. And as you noted yesterday, another one of these guys who's like 29 years old at being a restricted free agent is ridiculous. But
and if they, anyway. If they keep him, they have two low first round picks. So I, my kind of assumption right now, if they keep Hayward and Hill at those prices, is that they will be a very low luxury tax team next season. And that includes Rudy Gobert's already agreed to extension. Then the next year is when you could see theoretical pay increase for Derek Favors, who is only making $12 million next year. And now the probably the window for renegotiation and extension with him is over because they're going to be an over the cap team is our assumption next year. And so that's that year. Also, Dante Exum is going to be a restricted free agent that year. And Rodney Hood is going to be an extended. So then that's the year where if they want to keep it together, it's going to get ridiculously expensive. They're going to reach like Portland territory if they want to keep that team together.
Yeah. And they don't have the type of deep pocketed owner like Paul Allen in a small market who necessarily is going to go into that. I mean, I could see them if they're really in contention. So much of this depends on what happens now. Like, how does George Hill play the rest of the year? How does George Hill play in the playoffs? If he is just kind of okay and they lose in the first round and it doesn't look like they're really close, now perhaps they're going to start playing for next year. But then maybe Gordon Hayward leaves if George Hill doesn't come back. So there's that component of it too. Are you going to play George Hill the max? $30 million a year for what, 3 years? I mean, it seems like he seems to think he's going to get more than that because it sounds like he turned down a renegotiation and extension that would have been essentially 3 years, $89 million in new money. So 3 years at the max, that's like, you know, probably in the mid 90s. It sounds like he's going to want even more than that. If you go into that fourth year at that type of money, now it's like, it's very difficult. That is going to get it to be an untradeable contract by the end. So, but, you know, maybe if they get to the second round and it looks like they're on the cusp of really even being a conference finals teams, maybe you bite the bullet and pay that and just pair salary later. Because you and I both think about using, making luxury tax avoidance moves before you really have to and you really know what the situation is. I don't know. It's going to be a really tough decision for them now. And a lot of it will depend on what Hill's market is and perhaps even more so how they finish the season and what happens with Gordon Hayward. There's too many balls in the air right now for me to say what would be a good number, a wise number for Hill before you would just say, all right, we're going to walk away.
They have the single most interesting offseason in the NBA. Full stop. It's them for me. Like, I mean, they're the Clippers. It's maybe more important just because their players are.
What about Boston?
Yeah, but Boston's is entirely like it's not as much.
Yeah,
up
it's
to
just
them.
Either they get someone or they don't. Yeah, right. I see what you mean.
And because
yeah.
Boston, they're less decisions Boston will still have options. Like Boston can scoot one more year if they want to. You know, they can draft whoever they get with the Nets pick. They can. I don't think that's the right tactic, but they could do that or make smaller moves just because the guys don't come. With Utah, it's all this summer. We're going to know basically everything. And that's what makes it the most interesting.
Dude, there are so, I'm not disagreeing with you, but there are so many fascinating offseasons. There's the Warriors, a little bit of drama on whether Kevin Durant comes back. I'll assume that that's going to happen. But then what happens with Iguodala and Livingston, whether Durant takes the 120% or he demands a full max contract. The Rockets could get into, you know, maybe even having max cap space this year. You mentioned the Clippers with Blake and CP free agents. The Celtics are good team will have max cap space.
Nuggets and Wolves.
Yeah, those are good. The Hawks are going to have some fascinating decisions to make with their free agents, including, you know, Paul Millsap. Are they going to max him out again? That's going to be a really interesting one as well. I mean, there are a lot of good teams or decent teams, at least, that have some very interesting decisions. The Pacers with Jeff Teague, another one. So many of these teams are going to have players with full bird rights that they can probably just give the max to and likely keep their guy, but then that might be a bad contract. Are you at the place as a team where you want to give a ton of money to these guys? Some really, really difficult decisions. And then you throw in the fact that nobody knows what the hell the market's going to be this year because there was so much money around the league last year. Agents are expecting that everyone's going to get paid at that same level. That's not going to happen because there isn't as much aggregate cap space around the league this year because of all the money that was spent last year. So where is that line to be drawn? I'm just so fascinated with this offseason, but I agree with you. I mean, so the Jazz are a perfect example with these good players they have as free agents, and then the fact that they have more guys that need extensions is really going to be crazy. I mean, that's why when we did the salary cap deep dive at the sports business classroom last year, the like practical example that I gave was this summer's Jazz, and we built in a bunch of scenarios and had the students go through and practice it, because there are just so many weird options and permutations.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. Another team I want to mention is Toronto. They don't have much flexibility, so they don't have variability, but what they do with Serge Ibaka.
That was the one I forgot. Yeah. The Lowry thing, PJ Tucker, Serge Ibaka, all those guys.
Valanciunas. Are they going to line up to pay a giant salary tax bill? Or are they going to figure it out later? Are they going to try to move him now? Are they going to use one of their million young centers like Poeltl and try to start him? It's going to be like last year was basically like us standing on the edge of a cliff, just wondering which teams were going to fly past us and go off. This year.
Yeah.
And we knew, like, it was so funny last year when I was, so I wrote, and I'm going to do this again, assuming I have the time. I
don't think that Lakers car is going to be able to stop. He's going 100 miles an hour. What is he doing?
So like I wrote last year,
it's a 3,000 foot drop. Doesn't he see that?
They don't have a parachute for the car. But so like last year when I wrote for the Sport News, I did off-season previews for every team, and I'm going to do that again this year, assuming I have the time. And a lot of them were predicated on the idea of they really just shouldn't spend, but they're going to. And like this year, you get to actually get into the nuance of it, you know, like which teams it's smart to spend, which teams it isn't. And then also the market this year is very different. If we assume that the top guys are going to stay, and for certain guys, that might not be a fair assumption. But if we go with that, it's like, okay, not only do you value your guys, but what do those guys all over the place? Because there aren't that many just straight up max guys. You know, it's Gordon Hayward and really of the guys that could possibly change teams, that's really about it. So George Hill, Jeff Teague, Drew Holiday, the guys that we, you know, that have moved around, some of them, like all that sort of stuff. It's a totally different year. And then you have throw in the restricted market, which is going to be with guys like Nerlens is going to be really interesting. It's going to be awesome. Like this is going to be way more fun for me than last year where I was just scared the whole time.
Can we just skip like the playoffs and the finals and just get to that right
no,
now?
No, it's all fun. The only part of it that isn't as much fun is the next month. Like basically that's the holding pattern.
Yeah.
But the tankathon part's going to be fun. The figuring out what happens now with the one seed in the West, figuring out how the East shakes out. Like there are plenty of storylines worth watching, but I would say that March is the least fun of the next like 5 months of NBA. 4 months probably. I could do the math, but I don't want to.
All right, that'll do it for today. But
can I promote something?
Let's do it.
Yeah, okay. So I just released before we recorded this, so it'll be out by the time people listen to this, a very fun Real Jam Radio podcast with Nathaniel Friedman, who was Bethlehem Schultz, Free Darko, now writes for GQ. We go all over the map. I deliberately didn't put in timestamps or notes because I think it's fun to go through that. It's a very, very different conversation than the type of stuff you and I do, but I really enjoyed it. Go through, like, we ended up kind of talking a while about the influential teams that didn't win championships was kind of one of those. So 7 Seconds or Less Suns and a lot of other ones. And that was a lot of fun. And then, of course, my other standard stuff for The Athletic, and actually have some stuff coming out for the Sporting News just when it gets through the pipeline. Pick protection and front loading contracts was a storyline of last offseason that I wanted to talk a little bit about.
All right. Sounds good. Don't forget about the Twitter NBA show, Second Screen, 8:30 Eastern for Spurs and Warriors on Saturday. It's going to be a really fun one to do. Looking forward to that. If you haven't heard of this before, you basically watch the game with Danny and me. And don't forget our sponsors today, HubbleContacts.com. Get your first 2 weeks of contacts free. And then ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/CapSpace lets you try them for free as well. We'll be back after the weekend. Talk to y'all then.